Right, so welcome back to Math 583. Are there any questions at all about anything that I've said so far? So first, one thing, what is your name?
Me, Robert.
Robert. So Robert pointed out a typo in the notes from last time. I had written
that Q, which is e to the 2 pi I z, is a, in the notes, not in class, but in the notes I wrote that it's a map from C to the disk, and that doesn't make sense. I mean, it is a map on C, but it's not a map to the disk. So in the notes, you should change the C in the domain of Q to H, the upper half plane, which is then mapped to the open disk.
So
just to point out that I have the domain typoed in the notes, though not in the presentation. Yeah. All right, so what I'll do today is I'm going to define modular forms of general weight and level. So finally we'll get to the good stuff. And I'll also talk a little bit in general about congruent subgroups, which are the groups on which you define modular forms of higher level. And time permitting, or as a commercial break, I'll talk a little bit about Serre's conjecture and an application of modular forms to understanding lattices. Okay? Again, any questions at all? Okay? So, here we go. So, the notes are the same as what I handed out last time, except one new page on congruent subgroups, which is right here, and which everybody should have a copy of. But I'm going to start with section 1.3 from last time. And I'll do that by defining a group. So here, let's let gamma of n be, for any positive integer n, the principal congruent subgroup of SL2Z. N is a positive integer, and gamma of n, this is the kernel of the group homomorphism from SL2Z to SL2Z mod nZ, where SL2Z mod nZ is the group of 2x2 matrices with with entries in Z mod nZ, with entries in integers modulo n that are, of course, invertible, but moreover have determinant equal to 1 modulo n. So this is a group from before SL2Z. It's a group, and reduction modulo n gives a homomorphism with finite index and obviously normal kernel gamma of n. So also equivalently, right, an exact sequence, 1 gamma of n SL2Z, and then SL2Z mod nZ. And it's a non-trivial, but not that non-trivial, fact that this reduction map is surjective. It's not completely obvious. It's obvious, for example, when n is prime, but in general, it's not completely clear. I mean, you could imagine having, say, a matrix here with, say, lower left and lower right entries C and D, and these will certainly be co-prime in the sense that the GCD of C, D, and N is equal to 1. So here I'm imagining lifting C and D to actual integers that represent the elements of Z mod nZ, the lower two entries of the matrix. Certainly you would have this, but this doesn't mean that C and D are co-prime themselves. For example, if N equals 6, and C equals 2, D equals 3, then the GC, oh, sorry, that's a bad example. It's really easy. So, how about this? C equals 6, D equals, this is kind of done, 2, and N equals 9. So that's an example where the GCD of C and D is not 1, but the GCD of 3 altogether is 1, right? And the statement that this map is surjective says that if you take a matrix with lower entries 6 and 2, modulo 9, you know, and find something to fill it in that has determinant 1 modulo 9, that is possible, by the way. You could kind of do that as just a little exercise. But actually, we should. So somebody help me. Let's find integers a and b. So this has determinant congruent to 1 modulo 9.
Say what?
We could say.
Just take like 0 and an inverse maybe.
Yeah,
that'll work, yeah. Take 0 and then something maybe 5. See, 10 minus 0 is 1 modulo.
Thank you. What's your name?
James.
James, okay. Yeah, you told me last year. I forgot your name now.
Robert.
James Robert.
Okay, good.
Thanks.
All right, so 5062. And this is an element of SL2, Zeeman 9Z. And this claim that this map is surjective says that there's a way of lifting this to a matrix with integer entries and determinant 1. I guess this is, it's not obvious because look, this is a matrix with integer entries, but it has determinant 10, which is not 1. There's some way, though, of choosing integers that four integers that reduce to these modulo 9 and for which the determinant is 1.
I'm not going to explain why you can do that. I'm just going to leave it at that, just mention that it's true. If you want to understand this, not only in the case of n equals 2, the same statement I just made is true of any subscript here. You can look in, for example, Shimura's book, Arithmetic Theory of Automorphic Forms, Introduction to the Arithmetic Theory of Automorphic Forms. And he proves in chapter 1 that this map is surjective for all, for 2, 3, 4, and so on. Okay? So I'm not going to go into detail about that. But I will use it. If it isn't an exercise, it will be an exercise at some point. And if it isn't, one for this week. I think it's an exercise somewhere later in the book. In any case, we won't need this fact at all for the definition of modular forms. It's just something that will be very important later for algorithms to compute with modular forms. All right, so now I'm going to tell you what a congruent subgroup is. The definition is pretty easy. It's just any subgroup of SL2Z that contains gamma of n for some n. A congruent subgroup is any subgroup G of SL2Z may or may not be normal that contains gamma of n for some n. So that's what a congruent subgroup is. And I'm going to define and only define modular forms for congruent subgroups of SL2Z. Also, another thing, the smallest n that works, for which gamma of n is contained in G, let me draw a picture that will stick in your head. SL2Z, side of it, you have a congruent subgroup. There are lots of them. I'll get some examples in a minute. And down here, you have gamma of n. And this need not be normal. Though, of course, gamma of n will be normal inside of G, because gamma of n, if n is the minimal one, is the kernel of the map from G to SL2Z mod nZ. Yeah. I've never thought about that before, but that seems to be right. So that it's a kernel of a homomorphism from G to something else, so it's normal. Okay, so this is a picture to keep in mind. One example of a congruent subgroup is gamma of n itself. Two other very important, in fact, the most important examples of this course are gamma 0 of n and gamma 1 of n. And here, gamma 0 of n, this is the group of matrices A, B, C, D, so that when you reduce them modulo n,
you get something that's upper triangular. And these are NSL2Z. So there are various ways of writing it. You can also just write such that N divides C, but I think it's better to think of this as the matrices that reduce to the upper triangular modulo of N. And the reason that's a nice way of thinking about it is because what is gamma 0 of N? It's just the inverse image of a natural subgroup of SL2Z mod NZ via this reduction map. If you want pi sub N, then gamma 0 of N is simply the inverse image of the group of upper triangular matrices in SL2Z mod NZ. Which you can think about more conceptually, say, as the group of matrices that fix the line span by the first basis vector. So it's a little more conceptual to think of gamma 0 of N that way. And also the 0, just to remember this, you have a 0 right here. Maybe that's awful. And there's this other group, gamma 1 of N. And this is the inverse image not of the upper triangular subgroup, but of the group that actually fixes the first basis vector, namely 1 star 0 1. So everything is exactly like what I wrote above, except the congruence is with a matrix of the form 1 star 0 1. So these are two examples of congruent subgroups. Gamma 0 of N contains gamma 1 of N. And they both contain gamma of N. And in fact, each of these inclusions each of these containments is a normal subgroup containment. But you have to watch out, and this will affect the theory a lot. Gamma 0 of N and gamma 1 of N for N greater than, I think for N greater than or equal to 2, are not normal subgroups of SL2Z. Think. So I'll just say in general, this is not a normal subgroup of SL2Z. So that just makes certain things a lot harder or more subtle than they might otherwise be. Okay, so, and also gamma 1 of N is not a normal subgroup of SL2Z. Okay, so these are the two groups, and it's a really good idea to just memorize right now the definition of each of these, because I'll just say gamma 0 of N, gamma 1 of N a million times in the rest of the class, and if you have to look it up each time, it'll be annoying. So, and I know for a fact that it takes people a while to remember which one is which. I just remember in grad school, students studying number theory for 3 years and still being confused about which one's gamma 0 and which one's gamma 1. So I don't know why, but the fact of the matter is people have trouble remembering these. But it's just language, and you need to know. So these are really the two canonical examples of congruent subgroups, and it's really where all the action takes place. In fact, you can show that essentially any question about modular forms for a congruent subgroup can be reduced to a question about really gamma 1 of N, or in some sense even gamma 0 of N. All right, so that's most of what I wanted to say about congruent subgroups, at least about the definition. There are a few natural questions that appear, and that's what this new page that I added is about. So it's called Remarks on Congruent Subgroups. And there's a famous old problem called the congruent subgroup problem, which is, given there's all kinds of different groups where you can consider congruent subgroups, notice that these groups are all finite index, because they're groups that are intermediate between SL2Z and gamma then. Gamma then has finite index in SL2Z because the quotient of SL2Z by gamma then, just from the definition, is at least a subgroup of SL2Z mod NZ. In fact, it's equal to SL2Z mod NZ. And SL2Z mod NZ is clearly a finite group. So this is an index. But you can ask kind of a converse. If you have a finite index subgroup of SL2Z, is it a congruent subgroup?
And if you try to make up a finite index subgroup, you'll be hard-pressed to think of any way of making a subgroup up that you know is finite index, that isn't made up by, you know, describing it as, well, you take gamma of n for some n, and then you maybe take a subgroup of this and take an inverse image. This is really a natural way of making finite index subgroups. It turns out, though, that there are lots and lots and lots of finite index subgroups of SL2Z that are not congruent subgroups. And there's a reference in here that, of course, you can't see what it references because the bibliography is elsewhere. But if you download the full book from online, you can find out what it references. It's a paper about how to determine for a given G whether or not it's a congruent subgroup. So there's an algorithm based in some given some presentation of G that will allow you to decide. And in that paper, there are examples of groups that are not congruent subgroups. But interestingly, and I don't know how it's proved, but if you replace 2 by any larger integer, consider SL3Z, SL4Z, then any finite index subgroup is a congruent subgroup. So this weird distinction between finite index subgroups and congruent subgroups disappears, except in the case of SL2. Also, if you just throw away one, you localize the ring Z at one prime, so it has one less prime, that is, you invert a generator of one of the primes, then here, any finite index subgroup is a congruent subgroup again. So really, really, there's something very special about SL2Z and that congruent subgroups aren't every finite index.
That's one thing I wanted to say. Another thing is, a very frequently asked question is, how do you find generators for a congruent subgroup?
So, in fact, a week and a half ago, somebody sent me an email asking, how do you find generators for congruent subgroups? Some like woman grad student in Italy. But it seems like every 3 months I get a question from somebody, which is exactly that question. How do you find generators for a congruent subgroup? Because everybody knows SL2Z is this group generated by two elements, S equals 0, minus 1, 1, 0, and T equals 1, 1, 0, 1. It's maybe the first thing that most people ever learn about modular forms. And then they wonder, what is the analog of this statement but for congruent subgroups? And it turns out there's a completely generic way that works for any group. If you know generators for a group and you know coset representatives for a finite index subgroup, then you can write to generators for the finite index subgroup. And it's surely a completely standard thing in group theory that I just figured it out myself, but when I mentioned it to somebody, they said this is the blah, 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 blah in group theory. So it might be closely related to something called Todd-Coxeter, but I don't want to say that for sure. But it's really simple, and the complete proof and description is given in the notes. But I'll just tell you how it works. This is a way of writing down generators for any congruent subgroup, assuming that you have coset representatives. So let's fix a congruent subgroup G, not necessarily normal, in SL2Z. I'm going to tell you how to write down generators for G, just because people always ask this. These aren't necessarily the best generators. There are too many. They're not an optimal collection. There's a much deeper theory that gives you more closer to optimal collections of generators. And if you're interested in saying generators for G, add the abelian, maximal abelian quotient of G, then there's a much, much better way to get, or a much, I guess, more efficient collection of generators for that, which I'll tell you about later. But this method has the advantage, it's completely elementary, or fairly elementary, and it is very fast to write down these generators. It could still be useful for certain things. Okay, so here's what you do. You have your subgroup G, and you just let R be a set of coset representatives. So SL2Z is the disjoint union of G times R for R and R, for little r and capital R. Let me make sure I got the order right. Yes. I'll call this a right coset. And now I'm just going to show you a way of constructing two maps from R to G. And if you take the union of the images of these two maps, you get generators. Oh, that's interesting. So actually the number is twice the index.
That's what it is.
Okay, so I have these two guys, S and T. These are capital letters, and R is a capital letter, so I'm going to change them to sigma and tau. So I think the argument is more transparent if I call them sigma and tau. Lowercase letters will denote elements, uppercase letters will denote sets of elements for the moment. So I'll call them sigma and tau, and I'll define two functions, S and T, and these functions go from R to G. R is just a finite set because this G has finite index, so coset representatives. And the claim is that once I define these, the claim is that our group G is generated by the image of R union. The image of S union the image of T, which is a set of generators of cardinality, I guess twice the index. Notice the special case when G is equal to SL2Z, that's twice one, and that works out to be correct. Okay, so now here's how these two maps are defined. So all you do is, given an element little r, consider G times R, it's a coset. If you multiply this coset on the right by sigma, then you get another coset, which is G times R prime. So just define S of R to be
R sigma R prime inverse.
Now notice that this is in G because, if you multiply both sides of this equality by R prime inverse, you get the statement that G R sigma R prime inverse is equal to G, which exactly means that R sigma R prime inverse is in G. Yes, please.
The notes here say that R prime is unique. You're not just choosing this as a representative of the coset. Right?
The R here must be in the set capital R, which I didn't say out loud. Thank you very much. Then it is unique.
Okay.
Otherwise it wouldn't be. And that will in fact be very important, the rest of the system will define. Okay, is it clear now? You're happy. What's your name?
Robert.
Wait, you're Robert. Sorry. Are there any other Roberts? Any other Jameses? Alright, so I've given you a way of, for each element of R, writing down an element of G, and the only natural way you could possibly think of. And you do exactly the same thing for tau. G R tau is going to be G R, R double prime. So R double prime is in capital R. And they define T of R to equal R tau R double prime, which again is an element of G. So I've just written down 2 times the index of G and SL2Z generators for, elements actually, I didn't prove the generators yet, but elements of G. So S of R is in T of R, this is a collection of elements of G. And I have to admit, I don't know whether or not these sets are disjoint. If somebody can tell me, I would appreciate it. I just have never thought about that. But it would be nice to know, more precisely, does this set that I wrote down have cardinality twice the index? That's really the real question. I just have cardinality equal twice the index SL2Z? Question. I don't know. But that would be a good guess. Okay, so now the claim is just that G equals this, and the reason is following. Okay, so I'm going to prove to you now that this is an equality. Okay, but is the construction crystal clear to everybody? Okay, and notice that this has nothing to do with SL2Z or congruent subgroups. This is what I'm doing is completely generic group theory. This is a group, this is a subgroup, finite index, and I just define, and I have Cosy representatives for that subgroup of finite index. I use them to define two maps, and then I claim that the subgroup is generated by the images of those two maps.
Well, we needed the original big group was generated
with finitely generated. Well, no, we don't need two.
Well, two to
finitely, it has to be finitely generated. That's true. The original group must be finitely generated, and instead of two maps, you would have one map for each generator in general. Thanks for pointing that out. Thank you. Okay, so that's what we're using. And of course, it needs to be a finite index subgroup. So now here's the proof. I'm going to, in a sense, prove it by example, but it's a very convincing example. So I'm really just going to follow my notes. So we can assume that the identity matrix is the coset representative corresponding to the coset G, just for simplicity. It's not really necessary for the argument, but it just makes things a little bit simpler to think about. So just assume that that's in R, that it's one of the coset representatives. And now, suppose you have an element G in your group capital G. So little g is in the group capital G. And I want to show that it can be written in terms of these guys. Okay? So I certainly know that it can be written in terms of generators for this big group, SL2Z. So in order to simplify, or in order to keep the notation from being very complicated, my element G is the specific element sigma tau squared sigma tau, where remember sigma and tau are generators for SL2Z. So now I'm choosing this, and I'm going to show you how for this particular one. Well, I mean, it may or may not be in G. It really depends on what this is. But I'll just do something with G, and it will convince you that this equality is true. And if it doesn't, I'll work a little harder. But it should. I think it's very convincing. So here's something you can do. You can certainly write this as I times sigma tau squared sigma tau. Okay, no problem with that. We're multiplying by 1, kind of divided by 0 or anything. Now the interesting part is you can write this as S of I times y tau squared sigma tau, where y is a coset representative. Now why can I do that? Well, because I'm just using that. So a coset representative, namely I, times, I'm using this equation of R equal to I. S of I is equal to I sigma times some coset representative R prime, which we call Y inverse. And that tells me that, let's see today. Yeah, then just multiplying both sides by y, you get S of I, y equals I sigma. And all I'm doing here is writing I sigma equals S of I times y. So we're good, I hope. So all I'm doing is using the definition of S. And now, the neat thing is you can then continue this. The next thing you have here is a tau. So write this as S of I times y times tau, times everything that's left over, tau times sigma times tau. And now y times tau, it's really the same thing again. You have a coset representative times tau. And so again, using this, you see that, so coset representative times tau is equal to t of that coset representative times the inverse of some other coset representative. Wait, I think there's a missing inverse here. Should be the article of time interest. Sorry. I apologize. In the definition here, it's exactly the same formula for each of the generators. That there should have been an inverse here. There was a mistake when I wrote it on the board before, it didn't include the inverse. So now you multiply both sides by R double prime inverse, sorry, by R double prime, and you get T of R double prime equals R tau. So whenever you have coset representative times tau, you can sort of switch things, but you replace the tau by T of that coset representative, and then you put on the other side another coset representative. So I get to write this as S of I times a coset representative. Times T of that coset representative times another coset representative, which I'll call Z now, and then it's one of the rest, T sigma tau. And you can keep doing this over and over again, and what you get each time is, you'll end up with a huge product of S's times something and T times something, and at the very right, at the very end, you have a coset representative. So you have a product of elements of G times a coset representative, and that's equal to your original element. But your original element is in G. Therefore, the coset representative has to be the coset representative of the identity coset. So at the end, since that was just assumed to be I, at the end you end up with just a product of images of S and T. So that proves that S and the images of little s and little t generate the group. Okay, does that let it sink in for 10 seconds? Yes?
One question.
Sure.
Given an arbitrary string, it seems like at each step you sort of take the next of your original generators and sort of flip it around.
Yes.
Then you get a representative on the right. What happens at the last step? Does it kick out another representative?
Yes, exactly. But that representative, what you have now is an element of G, the big product, and you kicked out a representative at the very end. Like, maybe this is the last step.
If these weren't here, this would be the last step. In fact,
I don't want to confuse everybody's notes, but you could pretend this is the last step.
Then you have a coset representative, but this is in G here, and you know that the product of these two, this stuff times that coset representative, that product is also in G. Therefore, Z is in G. And therefore, it's a coset representative. It's the coset representative of the identity coset. Therefore, it's the identity element.
Oh.
Yeah.
I got you.
In fact, really, what I've given is an algorithm that, if you do what I just said, you get an algorithm that will tell you which coset a completely general element of capital G is in. And moreover, you can, using that, you can decide inclusion, whether or not an element's in G, and you can write explicitly an element of G in terms of generators, just by using this procedure. If you can write an element of G in terms of sigma and tau. And you can, to write an element of SL2Z in terms of sigma and tau, what you do is you take your element, say, gamma of SL2Z, and you take an element of the fundamental domain, you hit it by gamma, and you get some element, way over here. Then there's a standard procedure to get something that's again in the fundamental domain. It involves some iterative process, which is basically like the continued fraction of this thing. But you get it back in the fundamental domain, and the sequence of translations and reflections through the unit circle give you your element in terms of sigma and tau, at least up to sine, and you can figure out the sine. So there's a standard way to do that, too. That's how to give generators for a congruent subgroup. More generally, that's how to compute with congruent subgroups. That's what I've explained.
Okay, so now, finally, I really better define modular forms.
It'll be pretty sad that it took me a whole week. So now, I'll tell you about modular forms in general. Okay, so fix a congruent subgroup G. Very often might be gamma 1 of n or gamma 0 of n. Then make really make a bunch of definitions like before. A weakly modular function
of weight k where g is a weakly modular function of weight k for g is a neuromorphic function f on the upper half plane such that f such that cz plus d minus k f of z f of az plus b over cz plus d is equal to f of z for all gamma equals A, B, C, D in your congruent subgroup G. So that's a weakly modular function of weight K. And unlike what happened when G is SL2Z, there definitely can be weakly modular functions of odd weight. In fact, we can, there definitely can be these of odd weight. And with an appropriate understanding, you can make sense of these even in the context when k isn't an integer, which is very interesting. But, and even much more generality than that, if you cast to a p-adic situation. Anyways, that's a weakly modular function of weight k. It's just a function like this. Everything's basically like before. The only difference is you restrict to matrices in the subgroup. And the resulting thing you get is like a differential on the quotient of the upper half plane by the group g. And this group G is a Fuchsian group, so this quotient of the upper half plane by G, it's a non-compact Riemann surface. It's a Riemann surface minus a couple of points. So this set of functions, they're closely related after you make much better holomorphicity conditions on them to differentials. But in any case, that's the definition. They're just like before. And now, modular form. So remember before we had the Q expansion, and we got that by taking the matrix tau equals 1, 1, 0, 1, which is an SL2Z, and then just observing that it meant that, well, because tau is an SL2Z, f of z equals f of z plus 1. And that told us that f could be written in terms of e to the 2 pi iz. Periodic of period 1, it can be written in terms of e to the 2 pi iz. At least at the same volume. So, unfortunately, this is not in G in general. So, you have to work a lot harder, or a little bit harder, to get Q expansions in general. So, you don't have them.
But you do have something kind of like them, namely Q to the 1 over n expansions.
All right, so now I'm going to define modular form completely precisely. A modular form on G of weight k is a holomorphic function on f of h c such that same thing as we had over here. So it satisfies this transformation property, and all right, it's going to take me a little while to tell you what the and is, but and f is holomorphic at each cusp.
Now, in order to tell you what holomorphic at the cusps mean, I'm going to define a notion of Q expansion for F at any element of P1 of Q, and then holomorphic at the cusps mean that the Q expansions have no negative exponents. So they're sums starting at the zeroth power of Q and going on up. Or actually, yeah, well, zeroth power of Q. So all I have to do to finish this definition is tell you what Q expansion at a cusp is. And here it is. So what does that mean? So you have an alpha in P1 of Q, which is Q, so it's either a rational number or infinity. Then let's see. I'm deviating from my notes. Better not look at them. So choose gamma in SL2Z such that gamma of infinity is equal to alpha. And you can do this because SL2Z acts transitively on P1 of Q. That's the last full problem. So gamma of infinity equals alpha. And now consider the function here gamma is A, B, C, D. Consider the function CZ plus D minus K F of AZ plus B over CZ plus B. And just by F bar gamma K. In general, if you have a function f and a matrix gamma in SL2Z, this is just a new notation that's a little bit better. In fact, this notation is really good because this is a right group action on functions. If you have, say, gamma 1 and gamma 2 in SL2Z, then f bar gamma 1 times gamma 2, the bar k action is the same as acting first on that function by gamma 1, and then acting by gamma 2. So this is, again, something you should prove as an exercise, that you have a right action of SL2Z on functions on the upper half plane, given by this. And you have one of these actions for each k. So you have an infinite dimensional representation of SL2Z. In any case, returning to our story, this thing, f bar gamma k, it's a weakly modular function for, this is a weakly modular function for the group gamma inverse g gamma, which is also a congruent subgroup. So this is another congruent subgroup. It's just the conjugate of g by the element gamma. So for F to be, I'll define the Q expansion of F at the cusp alpha to be the Q expansion of F bar gamma K at the cusp infinity. And then all I have to do is define for you Q expansions at infinity for weakly modular functions. And then we'll be done. I've told you everything that goes into this definition. So just codifying what I said briefly on the blackboard. The Q expansion of F at the cusp alpha is, by definition, the Q expansion at infinity of F bar gamma K. And notice that if you substitute in infinity here, you get alpha out. So it's very much like looking at F and translating things that infinity is a neighborhood. Infinity looks like the neighborhood around infinity for this function is like the neighborhood around alpha for the original function F. OK, so now all I have to do is tell you about Q expansion at infinity, but I've basically already done that.
right? The only problem is that this function f bar gamma k, it need not be invariant under the matrix tau, which is given by 1101. But it lies in a congruent subgroup, or it's a modular function for a congruent subgroup. Congruent subgroups, say of level n, contain the matrix 1n, 0, 1. And hence, you'll end up getting a Q expansion for this in terms of Q to the 1 over n. So first, a heuristic reason. Well, if you contain this matrix, then you have some function, and it's invariant under a group that contains this matrix, then it'll satisfy G of Z is equal to G of Z plus n. Just because, notice the CZ plus D, the thing on the bottom, is just 1. So just like before, you get translation by some integer, leaves the thing fixed, but in this case it's something bigger than 0. Something bigger than 1. And notice that there's, if you look at e to the 2 pi iz over n, notice that this is also invariant under z goes to z plus n. So it's not surprising that a holomorphic function that can be written in terms, or that has this periodicity, can be written in terms of this. And you can prove that working just like I did before. Okay? And I'm not going to go into the details of that since I have only a minute and a half. So I think I've actually given the definition now. A modular function of weight k or on a group G is a function that transforms this way. It's holomorphic on the upper half plane. And at each of the cusps, well, you define a Q expansion by choosing a gamma that sends infinity to your cusp, considering this thing and looking at its Q expansion at infinity. Its Q expansion at infinity will be a sum, f bar gamma k is a sum, n equals some, assuming that it's meromorphic at infinity, let's assume it's holomorphic at infinity, it's a sum n equals 0 to infinity, a sub n over capital N, q to the n over capital N. It's a q expansion in terms of the nth root of q, or a trace of the nth root of q. And the condition that this is holomorphic at the cusp is simply that this q expansion starts with 0 and doesn't have a negative term. So that's it. That's the complete definition. And there's a notation for the complex vector space of such things. It's mkg. And it's a theorem that this is a finite-dimensional complex vector space for any k and any g. Finite-dimensional complex vector space. When k is greater than or equal to 2, there are not necessarily easy, but reasonably easy formulas for the dimension of the space. When k equals 1, it's extraordinarily difficult to compute the dimension of the space. You basically have to enumerate all, you have to enumerate a whole bunch of different Galois representations. It's very tricky. But for k greater than or equal to 2, there are nice formulas. At least for g equals gamma 0 or gamma 1. Okay, so I've now defined modular forms. Think about that over the weekend. And on Monday, I'll talk a little bit more about applications. In particular, I'll talk about Serre's conjectures on modularity of, well, basically an analog of class field theory, but for two-dimensional representations. And I'll talk a little bit about lattices, and we'll start talking about a compute level 1 modular forms. So thanks for all your comments and everything. Are you Stephanie from NAU?
Yes.
Also?
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you mean? Andrew mentioned to me. I mean, I graduated from NAU, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you live in Flagstaff before?
I grew up in Flagstaff.
Cool. Yeah, I lived there. It was 1989 to 1995.
Yeah, for state school, I was very happy with my education I got out of there.
So. Yeah, it's really cool.
It's a bargain.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and they're friendly in the department, and